Hi, I'm the person whose closet is put in color order, but I'll also pick up an earthworm without thinking twice. In fact, I did yesterday. It needed my help. I'm not afraid to be a little messy. Human nature is messy, but nature can help us embrace it. I love the brand Seventh Generation. Their laundry detergent lifts away tough stains with the power of bioenzymes. That's exciting. You wipe your hands on your pants after you pick up an earthworm. Seventh Generation is like, don't worry. Hug a dirty tree. Huff some bark. It's good for you. That is the power of Seventh Generation. Find laundry detergent and other laundry products at seventhgeneration.com. I love worms.
Don't just ride the index, seek to outperform it with Fidelity Active ETFs. Learn more at fidelity.com/active ETFs. Before investing in any exchange-traded fund, you should consider its investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. Contact Fidelity for a prospectus, an offering circular, or if available, a summary prospectus containing this information. Read it carefully. While active ETFs offer the potential to outperform an index, these products may more significantly trail an index as compared with passive ETFs. Fidelity Brokerage Services, LLC, member NYSE, SIPC.
Oh, just a content warning up top. We talk about all kinds of things in this. Sex, of course. Things you may not want to eat, things you might. It gets gross. It's disgust. What can I tell you? Enjoy. Oh, hey. So it's your friend who offered you a mint, and now you're overthinking why. Allie Ward, here we are. We're about to experience something together. It gets wild, friends. Come along. This is one that's been sitting in the stacks for a bit. It's kind of been fermenting because it was recorded over the summer right before I got really sick. And getting into it this week, I realized I had forgotten how absolutely unhinged this one is in terms of subject matter. Like, you're in for a treat. You're in for a treat. But first, thank you to Patreon. You submitted thoughtful questions for this revolting romp. And to join, you could submit your questions before our interviews. Just hop over to patreon.com/ologies, where it costs $1 a month to join. Thank you also to everyone wearing Ologies merch from ologiesmerch.com. Also, side note, thanks for all the really, really, really sweet supportive messages after last week's field trip episode of my getting surgery. It meant more to me than you know. And I even got some notes in our reviews. And to prove that I read every review, I pick a fresh non-rotting one each week, such as this one from RNRGLSLC, who said, love the theme song, love the tangents and secrets, love the rawness. I love that review, RNRGLSLC. And thank you to everyone who left reviews, including another user by the name of Poo Poo Pee Pee, who is right on target for this episode, because disgustology, it's a real term. It stems from the word gusto, which is taste. So it means a distaste or to put off one's appetite. So if you are hoping to stop snacking for at least an hour, you have arrived at the right place. I interviewed a Harvard-trained cultural psychologist who is now a professor at University of Pennsylvania. I got myself to this beautiful building in the heart of the metropolis, and I was warmly invited into his high-rise home.
Oh, what a great building.
Should I take my shoes off?
You don't
have to. Oh, what a view! Oh my gosh.
His windows were a panoramic vista cast in blue-gray as this afternoon summer thunderstorm churned over the city.
What's cozy for you?
Anything you like.
So I got settled in a deep chair next to the couch, and we had a lovely, just casual kind of chit-chat about spit, potty training, fork sharing, spoiled meat, xenophobia, sex kinks, funereal experiments, perfume that you may or may not want to buy, food you may not want to eat, the ick, nipples, World War II, and so much more. It gets spicy. So face your fears and get to know the emotion that keeps you alive with psychology professor, researcher, lauded expert, and he who bears the title officially of disgustologist, Dr. Paul Rozin.
First name is pretty easy. It's Paul.
Paul.
My last name is Rozin. My Russian name. My father came from Belarus.
Oh.
And when he came to Ellis Island, my father said, I want my Russian name.
Oh.
So I don't have the same name as many of my relatives.
Mm-hmm. But you can call him Dr. Disgust. Several news outlets have.
So in studying emotion, disgust turns out to be very convenient. toilet training, which is a very interesting thing, was, of course, a central issue for Freud, but it's disgusting.
Mm-hmm.
There's two things. People don't want to study anything Freud was interested in because, you know, we've gotten past him. He wasn't really a scientist, and we're a real science now. I mean, it's a fascinating area where you take something that kids love. They love poop.
Uh-huh.
And you get them to hate it, to be really upset by it. And that's an amazing transformation.
Yeah.
And nobody's really seriously looked at that.
Do you think that in psychology, people think of Freud as a contaminant and they don't want that contagion of being associated with Freud?
I'm not quite sure he's a contaminant, but certainly they don't want to be associated with Freud because Freud was not a scientist. He had a lot of interesting ideas. He didn't pursue them in a scientific way. He thought of himself as a scientist, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
The psychology has been fighting to be called a science ever since I've been in the field and since the middle of the 20th century. And they wanted to be with biology and chemistry, not with sociology and anthropology. And shedding Freud was part of that.
Mm-hmm.
So I wrote this paper on the seven holes in the body and how the psychology of each hole.
For more on this, you can see Dr. Rosen's 2007 address, Exploring the Landscape of Modern Academic Psychology, Finding and Filling the Holes, in which he explains, in the presence of holes, the clear demarcation between self and other is blurred, and each bodily hole offers both vulnerability and promise, which is so true. For what is our bodily self without access to that which surrounds us, without a hole for snacks? Our body's really hungry and probably dead.
I did one study showing that medical students who would dissect the cadaver.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so after they dissect the cadaver, they're much less disgusted by cadavers.
Huh.
Okay. But they're not less disgusted by fresh dead bodies.
Really?
In other words, it's very specific.
Shall we enjoy a reading from the book of Cambridge University Press 2023 titled Hedonic Adaptation, Specific Habituation to Disgust / Death Elicitors as a Result of Dissecting a Cadaver? Let's. So in this, Paul writes that by using the disgust scale as a metric, they find a significant reduction in disgust responses to death and, quote, body envelope violation elicitors. Don't know what that means, but I can imagine. So maggots or a dirty Kleenex might still be gross to a med student, but a cold corpse just becomes no biggie. So if you're scared of doing something new, like taking the bus or wearing baggier but more fashionable pants, just think, with exposure therapy, we can get more comfy slicing into dead people. So try the pants. Do it. You got this.
Have you ever had to interview anyone that works at a morgue and see why they're able to, like, eat their lunch around dead bodies, whereas another person would?
Yeah, first of all, some people can't do that.
Okay.
But they're not likely to become workers in morgues, of course.
Good point.
So you have a lot of selection. But people get used to almost everything. You know? Mm-hmm. That's the story. You get used to all kinds of getting old.
Yeah.
And you get used to the environment you're in. I had a case where we were doing a disgust study,
mm-hmm.
one of my favorite studies, and we were looking at actual exposure to real disgust things with people.
Uh-huh.
Our instructions were, we had 32 tasks, I think, we asked them to do. One of them was to take a glass and spit in it, and then would you drink the glass, the water?
Even though that spit was just in my mouth, I don't want to do that.
That's right. Isn't that interesting, Bob?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was just in your mouth. Okay. And we got a freshly cut pig's head from the butcher.
Mm-hmm.
And we said, we have a pig head in the refrigerator. Would you be willing to pull it out and look at it? Yeah. Would you be willing to touch it? Would you be willing to stick a pin in its eye?
Woof, woof.
And we asked that people listen. Some people didn't. Some people didn't. Then we said, no problem. If you don't do it, fine.
More on human relationships with animals in terms of food, not other stuff, in a bit.
And we had them do all these crazy things. We also had a starter's pistol, but we showed them what it was, and there's no real bullets in it. Would you hold it to your head and pull the trigger?
Mm.
And somebody, ooh, no, no. So we had all these dead tasks. We had a true Nazi hat from World War II, and we said, would you look at it? Would you touch it? Would you put it on your head?
Oh, boy.
Okay, so we went through this whole thing, and one thing we wanted to do was get ashes, cremated ashes.
Okay.
Everything we gave them was absolutely true. As we said everything was, what the Nazi hat was a real Nazi hat. And we decided we couldn't really do cremated ashes.
Hmm. People donate their bodies.
But we did want to get something that looked just like it. So we went to a crematorium, a student and I.
We take a field trip.
And we visited the guy who does this, and we explained what we wanted. And he said, oh, he said, you want to see cremated ashes? We said, yeah. He said, oh, come here. And he had this room full of, you know, like shoe boxes filled with cremated. He says, here's one. Here's another one. And he started showing us like he was selling them to us.
Oof.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And he was so thrilled. No one had ever come to him and said, I want to see what you do. Mm-hmm. And he said, you want to see your body burning? And he went on this whole thing. And we learned from him how to make from a dog bone mash. A ground bone and some mm-hmm. a couple of other things, how we could make it look.
So instead of someone's abandoned cremains, they opted for mashed up beef bones from a pet food store. And maybe they got creative with like some fireplace ash or some cornstarch or something. But it was a convincing craft project.
And we got an urn. We bought an urn from him. So we have this thing, which we said were cremated ashes. It's the only lie we told. Oh. And we asked people, would they look at the urn? Would they open the urn? Where they touch the ashes with their hand. Mm-hmm. So we had people doing all these things, and we measured how willing they were to do it. And we had previously, they had already taken a disgust scale months before. So we had measures of an indirect measure, and now we had a direct measure of how disgust, and so we could compare them. Mm-hmm. And the interesting thing about this study is after the study was over, they'd been through all these things, people said, this was terrific, they would say. I want to get my friends to do this.
Oh, geez.
Because, you know, this sort of playing with disgust that's safe.
Yeah.
It's sort of actually sort of fun.
Well, it's like Halloween is like a haunted house to them, but with real disgusting
artifacts.
Yeah, it's
like a haunted house. Yeah. That's right. So that's funny. One of the interesting things about disgust that's always interested me is how central it is in humor.
Oh, for sure.
There's all these disgust jokes. I mean, there's loads of them.
Toilet humor got its name for a reason. Yeah. Toilet humor, scatological humor.
Yes, that's right. And people can laugh at it as long as it isn't in their face. That is, they're not facing the disgust.
Right.
Somebody else is.
And if you'd like more on everything from chuckles to hysterics to roast comedy and slapstick, early in Ologies, I interviewed Dr. Lee Burke, who is a renowned professor and a gelatologist who studies laughter's effect on the body. And he says he's the guy who is serious about studying comedy, and he's not wrong, and he's a darling.
Going back a little bit, in terms of defining disgust, is disgust an emotion? Is it a reaction? Where does disgust fall in the spectrum of things that we can feel? How is it classified?
Well, it's classified as an emotion, and it's even classified as one of the big six emotions in psychology,
mm-hmm.
along with fear, anger, sad, happy, surprise. I don't like that one, and disgust. And there are other taxonomies. There's an Indian taxonomy which has 10 emotions, but disgust is one of those too.
Mm-hmm.
Let's explore a few extra emotions via the turn of the century, 2000, paper, Exploring Hindu-Indian Emotional Expressions, Evidence for Accurate Recognition by Americans and Indians, which list the culturally recognized emotions. This is via a rough translation from the Sanskrit as, get ready for this, anger, disgust, fear, heroism, humor or amusement, love, peace, sadness, shame or embarrassment, and wonder. I love that range. And I also love that wonder is an emotion. I'm in wonder about that. And I got to say, if you're not familiar with the emotions wheel, look it up. It's this thing. It's like a color wheel, but it has Western psychology's recognized six emotions, which are fear, anger, disgust, surprise, happiness, and sadness, with these subsets and variations under each of them. Like, under happy, there's peaceful, or remorseful is under sad. And disgust emotions can vary from judgmental to hesitant or disappointed. And if you must know, I have a laminated copy of this wheel up in my office. And I also purchased a throw pillow for the couch. And if Jarrett and I are pissy to each other, we literally bust out the emotions wheel pillow and we point to what we're really feeling, which is honestly usually fear, which has underlying feelings of anxious, inadequate, or even overwhelmed. How about that? And surprise emotions can include amazed or awestruck, startled or shocked or dismayed. Now, so what if you hate surprises? What if you hate them? I'm not one of those people, but some personality psychologists say that this is in line with higher prefrontal cortex activity in a part of the brain called the anterior cingulate gyrus, which handles thinky tasks like decision-making and attention to detail and avoiding mistakes. And according to this book, You Happier, these types of folks who hate surprises tend to be a little more stubborn, but they like routines and they have a lot of perseverance. Maybe they're a little more anxious. Maybe they hang on to grudges, but they really get shit done. And for more on personality psychology, we have an excellent episode with Dr. Samin Vizier, which I hope surprises you with energetic awe and amazement and eager astonishment, according to the wheel that I just looked up. But let's roll on backwards to disgust.
So it's got most of the properties of an emotion. It's got a facial expression that's clear. It's an acute feeling. You don't feel disgusted for a month. You feel disgusted. Mm-hmm. It's almost always tied to some event.
And where does that facial expression come from?
I think disgust is originally about rejecting offensive foods.
Okay.
That's where it starts. And that's, I think, where we see it first in children. And it's closing of the nose,
mm-hmm.
and opening of the mouth, gaping sometimes, sticking mm-hmm. your tongue out. That's all getting rid of things. It's expelling it.
And you're closing off your palate, really, yeah. right? To not let anything down
yeah,
the hatch?
Yeah, you're basically spitting out or closing it off. That's right. So that's what it looks like. And that is functionally what it is. Now, when you show that to something else, like, I say, Adolf Hitler, people, well, that's, of course, an extension of that same disgust. It's not about eating Hitler. But it's the same system that's applied to moral things now.
Mm-hmm. How can you tell that that is disgust and not anger, say, for example?
Well, okay. So first of all, anger is an approach emotion.
Oh, what's an approach emotion?
Emotion that when you experience it, you want to engage with the whatever stimulated you.
Okay.
You're angry at it. Whereas disgust is a withdrawal emotion. So it's very different. It's the opposite.
Uh-huh.
They're both negative. But one is a negative approach, the other is a negative withdrawal. Now, there is some overlap in the facial because this disgust thing mm-hmm. also bares your teeth.
Oh, yeah, you're right.
One anger face is also a disgust face. And this disgust face is not at all anger.
And that's just, you're not baring your teeth, you're just tongue out.
Let's turn our attention briefly to the varieties of disgust faces and the structure of disgust, which was co-authored by, yes, Dr. Paul Rosin. In it, you're going to learn that the nose wrinkle is associated with either irritating or offensive smells, and to some extent, bad tastes. And gape and tongue excretion, like, are associated with food offense disgust and oral irritation. But a raised upper lip correlates to boundary violations, like bodily or personal space, or certain moral offenses. And so humans evolved these signals way back, prehistorically. And this study was authored just a scant 30 years ago by Paul. But I'm thinking with the number of like selfie camera monologues we deliver to AI-equipped social media, biometric capturing platforms, I'm sure we have more data than we could ever use to analyze just what our faces are doing when we're grossed out. Someone out there, work with an evil social media company and figure this out. They'll do it for the sake of profit and coercion. You might not even have to get a grant. Just thinking about that curls my lip.
The upper raised upper lip is part of both anger and disgust.
Mm-hmm.
When disgust is a moral reaction to like Adolf Hitler, it's sometimes difficult to distinguish from anger because mm-hmm. psychologically, you're disgusted by Hitler, but you also want to hit him.
Right. That's an interesting notion. Is it disgust? Is it a lot about threat abatement? Is it really your...
Yeah, it's a threat. You could say it's a threat, but it's not a threat that's directed at you. So it's one that you can withdraw from. Here's an example. Mm-hmm. If you're watching someone on the street dressed in a formal wear, a man and a woman, and the man steps in dog do
right.
on the street, that's really funny. But if you step in dog do,
that's so funny.
Not funny.
Oh, not funny.
I will say that it matters profoundly who steps in it and if I hate them. And if it's like a sweet couple that's celebrating their anniversary because it might be the last one before one of them dies because they have cancer, and like the nice man wants to take his beautiful wife out to this special dinner and she feels like herself in a wig and a fancy dress, and then he steps in dog doo left by some jerk who doesn't clean up after his expensive purebred dog from a backyard breeder, then no, that's not very funny and I'm having too many emotions. But yeah, let's suppose that the poo stepper, let's just pretend that that is your childhood bully who you later dated, but then they cheated on you with your boss and the two of them were going to a fancy dinner using your stolen credit card, and then one of them stepped in dog doo and you see it from across the street because you're hiding in a bush getting video footage for a court case. That's funny. And why? Okay, so I looked this up. In terms of humor theory, this example, this one example, touches on a few basic concepts. These have been noted by philosophers going back like thousands of years. And one of them is the relief theory, where something absurd happens to break tension in a situation. But there's also the superiority theory, where someone with power over you is humbled, and that's funny. And then there's this theory of disposition, where we can enjoy when good things happen to people we like, but then when bad things happen to assholes. So in this example, though, it's best to see it and not to smell it.
A lot of disgust humor, it requires that you be away from it. It's not really threatening you. That's true of a lot of things. I have a concept we call benign masochism, which is that people all around the world seem to enjoy the arousal of negative emotions, fear, disgust, as long as they're not really threatened by them. And that includes a roller coaster where you're not really falling to your death, but you think you are.
Yeah.
And the fear becomes part of the pleasure.
Mm-hmm.
And disgust at someone else's disgusting situation is you feel it, but it's not about you. You know, you didn't step in the dog though.
Yeah.
So that's part of why the now disgust humor works. It's a third party who dropped his lunch in the outhouse and has to go down and pull it out. You know, it's not you.
Again, that's your ex who cheated on you, so that's hilarious. And the most tension and release I feel isn't in like a $3 airport massage chair, but it's probably watching the television sketch comedy program called I Think You Should Leave. Every episode, every sketch hurts my soul, and I love it. I keep going back for more.
What about cringe humor, where you're watching someone have a really uncomfortable, awkward interaction and you're not even involved, but it just is like, ugh, like hurts to watch.
It hurts to watch, but the hurt is pleasant.
Right, right.
It's because you initiate it.
Right.
Because that's the same thing. So benign masochism is the idea that we enjoy these innately negative things because when we're secure that we're not threatened by them.
Mm-hmm.
That even includes jumping out of a plane on a parachute. It includes taking cold showers. There are a lot of things where you're body is not really threatened, but your body thinks it's being threatened.
But when we're disgusted or when we evade the threat that disgusts us, do we get any pleasure from surviving it?
We might get pleasure from surviving it. So the pleasure, for example, of pain from running a mile, mm-hmm, or 10 miles, there may be some feeling of overcoming, but it's also the actual pain can become pleasant.
Mm-hmm.
Not just the success, but the experience of the pain.
And if you need scholarly justification for remaining emo, you can see the 2023 study, Glad to Be Sad and Other Examples of Benign Masochism, co-authored by one Paul Rosin, which explains that hedonic reversals can be a major source of pleasure. And they can range from liking sad experiences like music or novels or tearjerker movies or like my entire college CD collection to enjoying food that's spicy or the strong taste of coffee or alcohol. Now, how bad is good? That's the question. So the study concludes that the favored level of initially negative experiences is something that's just below the level that can be tolerated. So I guess it's kind of like edging, but with a bummer. Speaking of, does this include kinks? We're going to get to that later. But back to his history.
And what about when your family came over? I was wondering, because you've done studies with Nazi ephemera. Did you have members of your family who were Jewish or who were...
My family's on both sides are Jewish.
Mm-hmm.
No one in my family was in Europe during the Nazi period.
Mm-hmm.
I've done studies on that. I know two people who are victims of the Holocaust,
mm,
who were in camps. They were anti-Nazi, but they had no problem going to Germany. And I knew lots of American Jews who never had anything to do with the Holocaust, who wouldn't drive in a Volkswagen, and who wouldn't, you know, wouldn't eat sauerkraut, all sorts of stuff. And I was really puzzled. I get puzzled by things. How could someone who was in Auschwitz for 2 years not be anti-German, and someone who's just sitting here, and none of their relatives even were in Germany, but they're so anti-German. And it turns out, just like we discussed, there's an enormous range of anti-Germanness in Jewish people. So we found that quite a few people who were, you know, in the Holocaust were not anti-German.
That's interesting, yeah.
And there's a lot of reasons. But one reason, very simple one, is that the German ones had experienced nice Germans before the Holocaust. Germany was not the most anti-Semitic country in Europe, actually. And there were lots of successful Jews in Germany. Mm-hmm. So they knew nice Germans, and then they met in the camps, the Nazis. And so we got interested in that. We studied about 40 survivors.
Wow.
And we got them to tell us, would they go in a Volkswagen? Could they listen to the German language spoken?
Mm-hmm.
You know, would they be upset about living in an apartment house which had a grandson of a Nazi living in that house?
Right.
And some of them, well, that's terrible. And other people, no, that's no problem.
Yeah. Oh, that's interesting.
But anyway, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of puzzling things about people.
Mm-hmm.
Go through terrible trauma and come out opposite,
mm-hmm.
you know, and we don't understand why.
Yeah. But it's great to be asking the questions. And what about you? What drove you to this particular niche? How did you find yourself as the godfather of disgust, a disgustingologist?
Well, it's actually a very simple story.
Okay.
I was studying what people eat and why they eat it. Perhaps the favorite food of humans around the world is meat.
Oh, okay.
So yes, this is true. And we discussed hunter-gatherer diets in the metabolism episode in January. And our lead editor, Mercedes Maitland, also has an anthropology background and chimed in, letting me know that meat and honey, not to say that's what people actually manage to eat the most, she says, but that's what are historically the most prized foods. And she continues, for example, in hunter-gatherer societies, people will tend to put more time and energy into getting X number of calories from meat than they would into getting X number of calories from plant foods. Now, how does this translate to you wandering indecisively at the mall food court as your lunch break minutes dwindle away? Well, according to the United States Food and Agriculture Organization, globally, pork is the most consumed meat, and it makes up over a third of the world's meat consumption. I wouldn't have guessed that. Next is birds. And yes, we have a whole episode about chickens. And yes, it's called Chickenology. I didn't make that up. It is what it is. Do not call me a fool. However, if you listened to the hydrochoreology episode recently about capybaras, you'd know that those big mammalian rodents are actually fish. Happy Easter.
But then it turns out that meat is also the most tabooed food.
Mm-hmm.
You don't get vegetable taboos very often.
Right.
Now, why is this food that is so desirable often prohibited? Sometimes they're tabooed for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And if you think of, say, Americans, there are 4,000 species of mammals. We eat 3.
Ooh.
Pigs, cows, maybe sheep.
Right.
That's about it.
Wow. Yeah, that's a good point. I keep thinking of birds. So.
What about the other 3,009... We are meat eaters and we love our meat, but we are disgusted not only by almost every species of mammal and of the other kind of species, but we're also disgusted by most parts of them. We don't eat eyeballs. We don't eat skin. We don't eat fat, you know, masses of fat. We don't eat a lot of things.
Mm-hmm.
We eat basically muscle. We don't eat brain. In the United States, we don't eat most viscera.
Yeah.
We just eat muscle.
Again, this is in Western or U.S. culture. And a fun fact, so the way that I met my spouse, Jarrett, was by walking into this organic nose-to-tail butcher shop. And he was behind the counter. He was wearing a chainmail apron. Oh, but that smile. And I remember he used to tell these tales of all these upscale, like Hollywood clients that just wanted either pork belly or a skinless chicken breast and no other part of the animal. They had to convince people to like try chicken thighs, but not a lot of people tossing pig kidneys into their air fryers.
So we're eating one kind of thing from only a few animals, and the rest of them are all disgusting.
Yeah. Why is that? Why culturally are Americans
like... I would say that the story is, first of all, almost all food discussed are animal products. Almost all.
Huh. Except for durian, maybe.
Yeah, but yes. And durian, of course, smells like it's rotting meat. Yes, that's right. So the question is, why do we find most meat disgusting? And that includes earthworms and, you know, all the and rats and all the things that we find disgusting. But another way to ask the question is, why do we eat any meat?
Right.
So we eat this tiny percentage of all the animal food we can eat. And the question is, how have we made an exception to that? You could ask the question either way.
Yeah.
But the important point is that there's all this great animal protein out there. And we don't want to go have anything to do with any of it. And even traditional cultures, which eat much more meat than we do, and more parts of the animal, still find many animals disgusting.
And he says in different parts of the world, different cultures eat different types of protein sources.
But they still don't eat at all. And they tend to not like decayed meat, which is generally disgusting. Now, there are exceptions to that, but they're very special. You know, there are cultures that eat rotted meat, but only in certain cases, and it's generally not consumed. So that's what got me going was, here is this most favorite food of humans.
Again, talking meat.
And people are rejecting almost all instances of it. And they're not just saying, I won't eat it, like you might say about paper. They're actually offended by eating. So I said, what's going on there? And that's how I got going.
And what do you think about types of meat that we'll readily eat, such as a hot dog, even though we know there's buttholes in it, but we wouldn't eat just...
We know there's what in it?
Buttholes. We know that it's full of anuses. A hot dog is full of lips
and butts.
You
can't be full of a hole.
Well, sure. It's sphincters.
You mean the liners of the...
Entrails. I love hot dogs, don't get me wrong, but I know that hot dogs are full of things that if they weren't like macerated and emulsified, I probably would not eat a hot dog.
Yes, in actual fact, I never looked at this here. It's a good question. What's in a hot dog?
Do we want to know? Should we learn this? You know what? Some wieners, you got to look straight in the face. So I Googled the sentence, what's in a hot dog, just level with me? And I got to say, the image search returns had a lot of appetizing photos of like crusty buns, taut meat links and mustard squiggles and the like. But let's give it up for People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, just busting out the disgust with photos of a vat containing what looked like giant ribbons of milk chocolate frozen yogurt, but what actually contained whipped and emulsified mussel. And I found myself knee deep in a clip on the YouTube channel for how it's made.
Traditional hot dogs are made from a mix of pork, beef, and chicken. The cuts they start with are called trimmings, pieces of meat left over from cutting steaks or pork chops.
And I realized this isn't, you're working with an audio only format, and you're welcome for that right now. But I'm going to have you visualize this because I had to see it. Just think of like an industrial stainless steel tub about the size of a minivan. And in it is a churning, fluffy, grayish brown substance. And I stared at it and I was like, what does it look like? And I realized it resembled Jabba the Hutt just rolling over in his sleep, just over and over. That in a vat, but it's liquid-ish.
I mean, and some of the things like that, sausages are actually encased in intestine skin, you know?
Right.
Yeah. So there's all sorts of ways that we work around a lot of these things. I mean, after all, people are breathing everyone else's air when they walk around, and they don't seem to be upset by that.
Right.
You go to a theater, you're sitting right next to someone, they're breathing, you're breathing their air in, and unless you're worried about COVID, you don't think about it. People aren't too upset about being in the same room as something disgusting, but they don't want to touch it.
Right.
So the touch and eat it, oh, that's terrible.
It's just exponential contact.
Yes, and eating is the worst thing. And no one, by the way, I don't think anyone's ever done disgust sensitivity of the vagina.
Oh.
But I assume it's somewhat like the mouth. I mean, the idea of touching a piece of raw meat to the...
I mean, it doesn't appeal, but then again, it depends on if the raw meat is alive and a person you know?
Yeah, well, I mean, if you look at what you don't want to put in your mouth, it's probably not unrelated to what you don't want to put in your mouth.
For sure.
Whereas, I mean, a lot of people wouldn't mind touching it to their ear.
Sure.
I mean, they don't want to touch it to anything, but the ear is not, it's a hole, mm-hmm. but, you know, it's a neutral hole, sort of.
So would I touch a piece of raw pork to my mouth? No. No. Would I touch it to my newly surgically altered vagina? Hell no, brother. And if you're like, excuse me, what did you get done to where? You can see last week's episode, Field Trip, Allie's Mystery Surgery. I'm going to leave you hanging. Just got to go listen. Now, would I let raw pork touch my ear, which is a neutral hole? I think I would. I think I would, because an ear canal is totally different in terms of consistency. It's not a blank canvas for contamination, like a mouth, a butt, or a cooter.
Is it epithelial tissue that makes us squeamish? Is it?
Well, there's epithelial tissue in the ear, too.
Is there epithelial? I didn't know that.
Well, there's an internal epithelium.
Okay.
Which is a little different, which is the moist one that you have in the vagina and the mouth.
I fact checked this, and yeah, it checks out. If you still don't believe me, you can skip over to the 2019 paper, Single Origin of the Epithelium of the Human Middle Ear, like I did. But epithelial tissue, it's all over the body, okay? It comes in a variety of cellular shapes, like scale or squamous, or tube-shaped cells, and even cubic-shaped cells. And this type of epithelial tissue, it's all over our organs, our blood vessels, it lines cavities. And if you're like, what does epithelial even mean? I'm glad you asked, because I just learned that its etymology in Greek means on the nipple or of the teat. And apparently, even the epidermis is a type of epithelial tissue. So this is news to me. I'm all ears.
Yeah, a little bit in the nose. So it could be the moisture that's... Moisture sort of makes things more conductive.
Right. What do you think of the word moist?
What do I think of the word?
People hate the word moist. How do you feel about that?
Yeah, moist is, well, you know, a lot of disgusting things are damp.
Yeah.
Wet. And viscera are wet. Well, moist in English has a certain negative. If you ask people, is moist a positive or a negative word?
Right.
Or damp, they would say negative. So moist is a feature of solids that's often associated with decay. And there are plenty of foods that are moist. So moist is fascinating. It has a negative overtone. I think you're right, in English.
Oh, I wish we had a language expert to explain why we hate the word moist, among others. But I stumbled upon an article titled, A Language Expert Explains Why You Hate the Word Moist, Among Others, in Vice. And that pointed me to a 2016 scholarly article called A Moist Crevice for Word Aversion, in Semantics, Not Sounds. And they concluded that around 10 to 20% of the population gets the creepy crawlies at the mention of moist. Now, if you listened to our rhinology and our hagfishology episodes, both bangers, in the past, I left all the shits and the fucks in, but I bleeped any mention of the word mucus for sensitive listeners, mostly myself. And I have since matured, and though the word mucus very much still on my shit list, I grit my teeth and I get through it, but know that it hurts me. I don't like it. But anyway, back to that 2016 study, which continued that word aversion is more prevalent among younger and more neurotic people, and it's more commonly reported by females than males, which personally, it tracks. That's making sense for me. But this is all just when it comes to words, at least.
What about culturally? Do certain cultures tend to be quicker to disgust than others?
We do know that women are more sensitive to disgust than men,
okay.
At least in Japan and the United States.
Okay.
It's been these two places I know, maybe more than that, because there are disgust scales measuring sensitivity.
Oh. And
there's an enormous range of disgust sensitivity. There are people who are almost show no disgust.
Who are those people?
Regular people.
Regular people, but are there certain like neurodivergences? Like are people with ADHD less likely to be disgusted? Or
I have no idea about ADHD, but in a quote, normal population, you find people who are hypersensitive to disgust.
Yeah.
So for example, one thing we criterion we use, would you blow your nose in a brand new piece of toilet paper coming right out of the package? Yeah,
sure.
But there are people that won't do that.
Okay. Oh, okay. Oh, because
so
it's
very
toilet.
Sensitive.
Oh, yeah, I wouldn't care about that.
Well, you see, but you're probably somewhere in the
middle.
Yeah, like
somewhere in the
everybody.
Middle. Yeah.
And there are other people who can't believe that anybody would be like that and really don't find feces disgusting.
Who are they?
I mean, it also depends on whose dog it is. I don't want to pick up my friend's dog's poop, but I'll pick up my own.
Well, that's an interesting issue there, too. Why are we relatively insensitive to our own poop?
Yeah.
And, of course, you better be, because otherwise you're carrying it around with you all the time. Is it?
Yeah.
So the people are definitely much less sensitive to their own poop. Sometimes it extends to your lover's poop. Mm. Sometimes it doesn't. Your baby's poop, yes, but mothers typically find their baby's poop much less disgusting than some other babies. And you said it with your dog.
Right. Yeah, I'll pick up my dog's poop all day, but do not ask me to pick up another person's dog poop. Ugh.
Oh, man, I just had the cringiest feeling because I remember during that soiree I had with my girlfriends before my surgery. I talked about it in the field trip episode. My friend Daylin was over early and she's like, anything I can do? And I was like, can you take Grammy for a walk? My hands are so full right now. And I had completely forgotten until right now that Daylin cannot stand picking up other dogs' poop. And she did it. She didn't say a word about it, but I just remembered it. And now I want to die. Also, that night, I suggested my friend Sarah, I was like, you got to try one of these grapes. These are such good grapes. And she reminded me that to eat a grape is incredibly difficult for her because if it were squishy, it would signify a little bit of rot and she would gag. So I'm over here. I'm just doing amazing. Like, anyone want to come see the pig head in my refrigerator or touch this bowl of bone dust? Let's party.
Now, you could say about yourself, your own poop, that's, of course, you're not threatened by your own poop biologically because you already have all those organisms in you.
Yeah, that's true.
Whereas someone else's poop might have something that you don't have. But everyone agrees that disgust has something to do with infection and avoiding infection. So there's no question about that. So you could say that your own poop is less threatening and that's why you are less disgusted. I don't think that's the reason myself. Mm. But your dog's example, which I think is not atypical, there's no way that you're less threatened by your dog's poop than by someone else's other dog's poop.
Yeah.
So
maybe it's the devil you know. You know what I mean? Like,
well, it's a familiarity, but you love your dog.
That is correct.
So you could try to show, for example, the more you love your dog, the less you're upset about its poop. Now, I once tried to do a study like that. It was about looking at how intimate people are with their dog as in relation to disgust. So do they sleep in bed with it, so on, things like that. We wanted to look at that. So we went to the vet school here. We have a great vet school at Penn. And we went into the clinic waiting area and we interviewed people with their dogs.
Yeah.
And asked them these things. And we found, much to our distress, that almost everybody there sleeps with their dog, talks to their dog as if it's a child, and basically makes it into a member of their family. They treat it essentially as a human being.
I plead guilty.
And so we didn't get these people where dogs are kept mostly for protection or something, and they're not really cuddled with.
Mm.
Cuddle those pups, because according to the 2020 Frontiers paper, Household Pet Ownership and the Microbial Diversity of the Human Gut Microbiota, pets do increase the diversity of our microbiome, with dogs contributing more types of bacteria than kitties. And a 2017 New York Times article, Are Pets the New Probiotic?, reports that epidemiological studies show that children who grow up in households with dogs have a lower risk for developing autoimmune illnesses like asthma or allergies. And of course, animals can bring in the nasties like toxoplasmosis or salmonella if you cuddle with turtles. So doctors advise washing your damn hands before you eat. But what if the animal itself touches your food? Let's check out the 2020 paper. Bugs are blech, butterflies are beautiful, but both are bad to bite. Admired animals are disgusting to eat, but are themselves neither disgusting nor contaminating. Co-authored by, you guessed it, Dr. Disgust, Paul Rosin. And it found that the more you like an animal, the less bothered you are by it touching your food. So imagine a butterfly that alights upon your sandwich, just blessing it with peace and beauty. Would you want to eat the actual butterfly? Heavens no. But what if a cockroach with the big wings landed on your sandwich, one of those big flying ones, and licked your meat? Would you want to eat anything ever again? Maybe not. However, cockroaches are fastidious groomers, and according to our lepidopterology episode with Phil Torres, butterflies love to slurp shit, and they're often drunk off rotting fruit. So you would think that studying butterflies would be this hazy, rainbow of bliss, just set to like an Enya soundtrack. But Phil explains in that episode that in order to lure butterflies, sometimes scientists have to pee on cans of rotting tuna in the rainforest. So butterfly expertise necessitates a pretty strong stomach.
Now, there are people, occasional cases, neurological cases of people who have no disgust.
Where, what part of their brain is not firing?
It's mostly involves the insula.
Okay.
At the base of the brain, part related to the olfactory system, by the way, which is not surprising.
Right.
This disgust is about basically smell and taste.
Again, see our gustology episode about taste, which is linked in the show notes. And right now, take inventory. If you're snacking on a chocolate-covered banana or a sausage or a chocolate-covered sausage, just set it down for a sec. It's going to get rough.
And by the way, we've worked with chocolate dog doos, of course. We've made chocolate dog doos that look just like
dog. And they
we've made it with stinky cheese.
Oh,
stinky cheese and chocolate. So it smells like shit. And we'd ask people if they would eat it. Now
just the thought of it is closing my throat up.
But a simple thing to do is just take melted chocolate and make it into a dog turd. It's solid chocolate, perfectly good.
Right, right.
Just a reminder, this is a job. Once again, this is a job that pays money and you need a PhD for it. Amazing.
And you ask people, you show them that what it's made of is it's solid chocolate. Would you eat it? And a lot of people won't bite it.
I know. Just the thought of it is making my throat close. What's happening? My brain is just thinking about it and saying, do not put that in your stomach. Don't put it in your stomach.
Well, the thing about it is that we are built in a way that says that if it looks like an X, it's an X. Because in the real world, that's true. In the old days, if it looked like a tiger, it was a tiger. So you have something in your head that says, looks like dog do, it is dog do.
Mm-hmm.
Now you know in your brain that that's not dog do, that's chocolate. But that piece of your head is saying that.
Mm-hmm.
Looks like dog do is dog do. And, you know, you don't want to touch it.
How disgusted are you? Because your home is immaculate. And so...
I wouldn't go that far.
Your home is beautiful and it's so well decorated. Everything is in place. There's not a speck of dust anywhere. You're well dressed.
I wouldn't...
You seem like a very clean person.
Your description of my home doesn't resonate with me. I mean...
Immaculate.
It's not immaculate. It's okay. Yeah.
But do you fall on like the cleaner side, the more meticulous side?
No, generally speaking, you'd expect that most of the people who work in this area are relatively insensitive. Otherwise, they would be disgusted by their work and not do it. I had a colleague who worked with me who was very disgust sensitive. But generally speaking, I'm not particularly disgust sensitive. There are some things that I don't like that are a little bit disgusting, but no, I'm not disgust sensitive.
What's the most reliable test a layperson could take to find out where they fall on the scale?
Well, we can start with, I'm just making this up now. Okay, brand new toilet paper at one end. Would you be upset about blowing your nose and that?
Not at all.
No, but I'm assuming that's way in the extreme. Are you willing to use a public toilet?
Sure.
Yeah, but there are people who are really very upset about that.
Yeah.
How about used clothing?
Oh, sure.
Well, I'm just
I'll wash it. Yeah. I'm just thinking for myself. Yeah.
I don't mind any of those things. But then you can get to more difficult things. Some things that almost everybody's disgusted by, like a fresh piece of dog shit on the one hand. On the other one, on the other end, you have this brand new toilet paper.
Mm-hmm.
And you could just see where you stand. But there's a very wide range. This is something that people are all over the place on.
Just this morning, the same morning this will air, because we hustle our bustles here. Jarrett and I went to a park and we decided to spend some special married romantic time sipping coffee and taking this disgust scale quiz, which was co-authored by this week's guest in 1994. So we sat down at a park table. We got to work.
All right. Are you ready?
Yes.
Let's rate our disgust.
Are you recording this? You already recording?
Yeah.
Oh, good. You got to set up. Great.
Okay. Please indicate how much you agree with each of the following statements or how true it is about you. Write a number 0 to 4. 0, strongly disagree. 4, strongly agree. Okay. So the higher the number, the more you agree. I might be willing to try eating monkey meat under some circumstances.
I would say I guess three. I'm really opposed to eating monkey meat. But I can... Oh, that squirrel just did a backward somersault while he was trying to eat a stick. It was really cute. Sorry. I can imagine circumstances... Don't say that. Because I have ADHD and I can't find my pills this morning. I literally just went, squirrel! Oh my God, dude. That is really embarrassing.
While taking a test.
Okay. I can't imagine a circumstance where someone would be like, we're eating this monkey. It's... You know, a thing that we do. And I go, I guess, when in Rome.
Okay, I had a 3-2. All right, we can't go through all of these.
Fine. Bothers me to hear someone clear a throat full of mucus. Strongly disagree.
Strongly agree.
Weird. I would go out of my way to avoid walking through a graveyard. Two.
Oh, yeah? I used to have panic attacks when I was a kid going through graveyards. Wow. Driving by one, because I used to have nightmares of bodies coming out of the ground. Anyway, we watched Poltergeist.
Seeing a cockroach in someone else's house doesn't bother me. Mildly disagree.
Strongly disagree. It would bother me tremendously to touch a dead body.
Two.
Strongly disagree. If you have been raised Catholic, you have touched... I've touched so many dead bodies because you kiss their cheek or put your hand on them.
It's like really?
An open casket thing, yeah. I've touched at least 3 or 4 dead bodies.
I probably would not go to my favorite restaurant if I found out that the cook had a cold.
A cold or COVID? Because that's real different. It would not upset me at all to watch a person with a glass eye take the eye out of the socket. It would not upset me. It would bother me to see a rat run across my path in a park.
Strongly disagree. Don't give a shit.
Mildly disagree. Wow. I would rather eat a piece of fruit than a piece of paper.
I strongly agree with that.
At the end, it's going to be like, please eat the piece of paper. Okay, even if I was hungry, I would not drink a bowl of my favorite soup if it had been stirred by a used but thoroughly washed fly swatter.
I strongly disagree. I would do it if it was washed.
I would not drink it.
It would bother me to sleep in a nice hotel room if I knew that a man had died of a heart attack in that room the night before. Mildly agree.
Mildly agree, yeah. You see maggots on a piece of meat in an outdoor garbage pail. Moderately.
That's very disgusting. It's still very disgusting. It just is.
I would say moderately disgusting because I like bugs.
While you're walking through a tunnel under a railroad track, you smell urine. That's just living in the city, babe, but it's still moderately disgusting.
Yeah, moderately disgusting.
Your friend's pet cat dies and you have to pick up the dead body with your bare hands. That's slightly disgusting. Well, how recently dead is it?
I would say not disgusting at all because it's my friend's cat and so it's an act of love.
That's fine. I'm going to do 0-2. I think I'm going to go with a recently dead cat.
Look at this next one. You see someone put ketchup on vanilla ice cream and eat it. That, to me, is one of the most disgusting things that I've seen here.
That's so funny.
That's a 4.
A 4 for you? Because I appreciate how weird it is, but I'd be like, I've eaten a lot of weird stuff.
It's jam. Because it's fruit and sugar and spices.
Yeah, it's like strawberry syrup.
It's disgusting to me. You discover that a friend of yours changes underwear only once a week.
That's a 3. That's very disgusting.
Yeah. I hope it's circumstantial and not habitual or philosophical. You're walking barefoot on concrete and you step on an earthworm.
I do find that extremely disgusting.
Okay, so here we go. Finally, add up all your responses to all 25 and the total will be a number between 0 and 100. I'm so curious.
Okay.
What's yours?
I got 41.
Ooh, I got 48.
Pretty close. Plus we're in the lower end of disgusted people.
Those sirens are not coming from the road if you're driving. That was in the park.
That's the police coming to arrest us.
Yeah, they're coming for us for being gross.
So, 48 to 41. Perhaps we're going to make it in this big, disgusting adventure we call life.
And it's important to know this because... For example, if you marry someone.
Right.
Are you married?
I am, and I'm married to an absolutely gorgeous, wonderful slob. I would say I'm normal. I'm not normal to neat. Yeah. And my beautiful, amazing husband, it looks like a bomb went off in his car.
And for more on ADHD, you can see the Attention Deficit Neuropsychology two-part episode with world ADHD expert Dr. Russell Barkley, as well as part two, which has How to ADHD's Jessica McCabe and Renee Brooks of Black Girl Lost Keys. And we also discuss really great resources and books for folks who have ADHD and how their family and friends can learn to stop getting mad at them all the time for the way that their brain works.
He says he's messy, but he's not dirty. He hates filth, but he doesn't mind
clutter. Well, that's another issue. That's right. Messiness is not really disgusting.
Okay.
I mean, to most people who are not that sensitive to the,
yeah,
they see that as disorder, but
right,
it's not the same thing.
Like he changes into inside slippers when he gets in the house. He will not wear outside things into the house. And as soon as he gets home from the gym, he washes his clothes and takes a shower.
So, yeah. Okay. But you see, so there are lots of people who are disordered in their possessions, but very clean.
Mm-hmm.
I prefer everything orderly, but my office shed is home to at least 7 alive spiders living their best lives just in these dusty webs full of dead bug husks. And my husband, he does a much better job of like scrubbing dishes and floors and vacuuming, yet he does not mind at all if his desk looks like it was raided by Vikings who are looking for a pen.
If you're married to somebody who's very different from you in disgust, you'll have great problems with sharing a bathroom.
Right.
For example, let's say you're the not disgusted. You'll use his towel.
Mm-hmm, sure.
And he would never use yours.
Right.
And gets really upset when you do that. And there's a lot of areas where you could have difficulty with people. It's all having to do with washing dishes and all kinds of stuff where, I mean, at the extreme, you'd want your own silverware.
Mm.
Not to have anyone else's mouth touch your...
It's interesting that we go out to eat all the time and don't even think about the fact that this fork was in someone else's mouth an hour ago. We don't even think about it.
That's right. Well, that's the way we get around this.
Yeah.
We don't think about the chair that we're sitting in a restaurant.
Right.
Had a butt of someone else up against it. We don't think of the people in the kitchen.
Right.
And what they're doing with the food, you know, are they sweating into it? Who knows what they're doing? Unless something hits us in the face, we don't think about it too much.
Well, what about disorders like obsessive compulsive disorder? And I know people throw around OCD, like, I'm so OCD, but it's an actual real disorder that doesn't...
Absolutely, but there are a lot, like disgust sensitivity, there's a wide range of a sensitivity.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people are OCD-ish, but they don't meet clinical criteria, but they have some of the features. One of the features being cleanliness. It's not the only thing.
Mm-hmm.
One form of OCD has to do with hypercleanliness.
And fun fact, that's not the only type of OCD. This is a giant misconception. So there are other subtypes that involve symmetry and relationship questioning and sexuality questioning or intrusive or distressing thoughts like imagining violent scenarios or strict adherence to a moral code. And even a distressing level of perfectionism is under that OCD umbrella as an obsession. And compulsions are the behaviors repeated to try to feel better or to mitigate the anxiety. And those can range from washing hands to checking on things like locks or stoves to just avoidance that looks like procrastination or seeking reassurance to make sure that you're not an asshole. And a lot of people have OCD behaviors that they may not even recognize because we're so used to just thinking of like, oh, everything has to be really clean. But it's encouraging to know that it can get better with the right help.
Is there a part of the brain that's firing excessively in folks who are afflicted with OCD?
I don't know.
Yeah.
Maybe and I don't know if you could separate clean versus, I mean, there are people who are OCD about nothing to do with disgust, about the door being locked.
Mm-hmm.
Go back, you know, 6 times to make sure. That's very different in its manifestation from a disgust kind of OCD, but they both have the property of being repetitive, overwhelming concern.
I was looking at some brand new research from June 2023 out of the University of Cambridge, which found that OCD sufferers had higher levels of glutamate and lower levels of GABA in the anterior cingulate cortex, part of the brain, compared to people without OCD. And the severity of symptoms correlated to the amount of glutamate in the brain. And they also found that those with OCD-like behaviors, but not clinical OCD, have increased glutamate levels in one of the brain regions. Now, exposure and response prevention and more general cognitive behavioral therapy, as well as SSRIs, have shown to be effective treatments. But some psychiatrists are starting to use Lamictal, or its generic form, lamotrigine, which is an anti-seizure medication, as an off-label OCD therapy because it inhibits the release of glutamate in the brain, which is interesting stuff. Either way, I love my brain. I love your brain. And for other neurodivergent folks, this other study recently came out titled Disgust Processing and Potential Relationships with Behaviors in Autism. And that explains that in autism, there is evidence for differences in physical disgust processing. And research indicates that autistic folks may have higher or much lower sensory capabilities around certain things. So if you're on the spectrum and there are specific textures or tastes that like really give you the squicks, and then others you're totally chill with, that's common. And it may make you more adept at certain activities. And we all have individual thresholds and we can use them to our advantage instead of just being shamed into conforming.
Doctors are probably, and nurses are probably less disgust sensitive because they wouldn't have gone into that. They wouldn't want to deal with body substances.
Yeah.
So you get a lot of pre-selection.
Mm-hmm.
Extensive experience can make you more tolerant or more sensitized.
Because you overcame it, your sensitivity could go down.
And that's one of the issues in treating phobias. One treatment is to desensitize you, to expose you to very weak forms of your phobia and gradually make it. Another is exposing you to maximum form, which could be traumatic, but in some cases, at least, it makes you, you overcome the phobia. So, you know, you can go into a room full of spiders if you're spider-phobic.
I would love a room full of spiders. I have put myself in a room full of spiders.
See my office?
You like spiders?
I loved it. I love them. I volunteered at a spider pavilion at the museum. Free-range spiders everywhere.
Well, spiders are interesting, by the way, because spiders and snakes are a mixture of fear and disgust.
Oh, that's a good point.
For a lot of people. Yeah. An earthworm is sort of disgust.
Yeah.
It's not threatening. But a spider and snakes are dry, sort of, you know, they don't have that moist quality that goes along with disgust. Anyway, are we discussing what you want?
Yeah. Can I ask you questions from listeners?
Sure.
They know that you're coming on and they submitted questions for me to ask you.
Oh, sure. Yeah, it's just fun. I enjoy it.
Okay, good.
Okay, but before we get to questions, a quick break and a donation to a cause of the ologist's choosing. And Dr. Rosin would like it to go to Philadelphia's Interact Theater Company, which is dedicated to commissioning, developing, and processing new and contemporary plays that explore the social, political, and cultural issues of our time. So they're doing great work, so we'll send a donation there. And we'll also send a donation to the International OCD Foundation, since we talked about them so much, who's working to clear up misconceptions about obsessive compulsive disorder, saying, "We know it can be difficult for members of the OCD and related disorders community to hear the term OCD misused, which can belittle the disorder and contribute to stigma. That prevents many people from seeking treatment, and the International OCD Foundation provides resources for learning and treatment, so donations will go to both of those groups. Thank you to sponsors of the show for making that possible. This episode is brought to you by Merrick Pet Care. And y'all know I have a little dog named Gremmy, which is short for Gremlin. And y'all helped me name her. And there's nothing that we like more than seeing her happy, which means tasty dog foods. And Merrick has been crafting high-quality dog food for over 30 years. They were founded in Hereford, Texas. But Gremmy doesn't care about that. She cares about smushing her face in it and then licking the bowl. And I don't blame her, because they use real ingredients and home-style recipes like real Texas beef and sweet potato or Grammy's pot pie. Grammy's like, Grammy's pot pie. Get away from it. It's mine. I also like that on the bag, they show what's in it. And they always use deboned meat, fish, or poultry as the number one ingredient. And I think Gremmy appreciates that. So check out Merrick online or in your local pet store and look for their new packaging with real ingredients shown on the bag and inside it. Yum, 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 yum. Have you tried different meal kit options and you're like, what else is out there? You might want to try Home Chef. What's cool about Home Chef, you'd like to ask? Well, they have fresh ingredients, chef-designed recipes, delivered to your doorstep. We love a doorstep delivery. They got classic meal kits, pre-portioned ingredients, easy instructions. They got quick recipes ready in less than 30 minutes. They have oven-ready kits with pre-chopped stuff. You can also do quick microwave meals that assemble in minutes. Home Chef has you and the entire fam covered for good meals without the hassle. And I mentioned on this podcast that your podmother and I just had our kitchen ripped out. So we don't have a kitchen. We have a microwave in the living room. And that means, hey, Home Chef, we'll take those microwave meals that assemble in minutes. Thanks very much. Home Chef is like in a bad dating game of meal kits out there. I'm your soulmate. So for a limited time, Home Chef is offering listeners 18 free meals, plus free shipping on your first box and free dessert for life. You're welcome. At homechef.com/ologies. So that's homechef.com/ologies for 18 free meals and free dessert for life. Homechef.com/ologies. Must be an active subscriber to receive free dessert. Sometimes it takes a different approach to help you unlock your true potential. Capella University's game-changing FlexPath format helps you learn at your own pace and fit earning a degree into your life. From before you enroll to after you graduate, you'll be supported by people who are invested in your success, so you can pursue your goals knowing that help is available if you need it. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu. Oh, hi, it's me, the lady that checks a bunch of scholarly articles before she believes anything, Allie Ward. And I feel like we are similar in that we have a fair amount of skepticism and we like to dive deep and find out what the actual facts are. This is why when it comes to any kind of supplements, I enjoy Ritual, which is a female-founded B Corp, meaning that they're holding themselves accountable to not just the company, but also to the health of people in our planet. And they're clinically backed Essential for Women 18 Plus multivitamin. It has these high-quality, traceable key ingredients in bioavailable forms that are clean. Only about 1% of supplement brands are USP verified, and Ritual is one of them. So I like being able to trust what I'm putting in my body. From an aesthetic standpoint, I'll also tell you that Ritual are beautiful little vitamins. They look like lava lamps and they taste like mint. So taking my Ritual is part of my, I guess, morning ritual. That's probably why they named it that and I didn't even think about it. Anyway, no more shady business. Ritual's Essential for Women 18 Plus is a multivitamin you can actually trust. So get 25% off your first month at ritual.com/ologies. You can start Ritual or add Essential for Women 18 Plus to your subscription today. That's ritual.com/ologies for 25% off. Down the hatch. Now, if you're a patron at patreon.com/ologies, you get the inside track to send questions before we record. And many of you had this insider question, including Andrea Devlin, Caitlin Powell, Scott Sheldon, TJ McKenna, and Nicole Kleiman.
Okay. Several wanted to know if you've seen the movie Inside Out by Pixar, which has a character named Disgust.
No.
You got to see it. It's
Inside Out.
This is Disgust. Whether advising on your social life or on life's little messes, Disgust is there to, well...
Yeah, it's a Pixar movie, and they represent emotions. And one of the emotions is disgust.
Sorry, everyone. Okay, but I did look up that Pixar artists wanted really strong colors to represent those six core emotions, and that red seemed like a winner for anger. Sadness was blue, of course, and then disgust, which was voiced by Mindy Kaling, was a green color because, as the designers put it, when you see green food, it kind of indicates that it's gone bad. So let this be a reminder right now to just go grab your leftovers from the office fridge before it starts to smell like Satan's outhouse in there. Do it for everyone. But of course, not all disgust is food related, and not all things trigger disgust in everyone. And then I raise my eyebrows at you.
Jadine Lannon wants to know, what's the deal with things that are normatively disgusting or taboo, like urine, blood, feces, becoming sexual fetishes?
Okay. Well, first of all, we have the phenomenon, which really hasn't been studied much, of disgusting features of a person becoming attractive and in romantic relationships. Now, when you kiss, things exchange saliva, but that's not salient. I mean, if you think about it, it's happening, but that's not what makes it a pleasure. Generally speaking, well, okay, so let's just take something. Vaginal odor is appealing to some people, disgusting to others. There are people who will not do cunnilingus, males.
Feel bad
for them. Talk about heterosexual women. And there are others who love it. And similarly, I think for females with fellatio, cunnilingus is more interesting disgust-wise because it's moist.
Yeah.
So that's a big difference right off in response to this question.
Listen, you can do whatever you're comfortable with. It's your body. But if you're very famous and you talk about it on a morning zoo radio program, don't expect people to hold their opinions, DJ Khaled.
I don't do that. I don't do that. I don't.
Not even like for her birthday?
Nah.
Now, if she told you she don't do that, is that okay?
It's not okay. Because...
So either silence is golden, or you can go by the golden rule of doing unto others what you would like done to you. Or maybe what's golden the most is showers.
Now you get more into the kinky side with people who are interested in being urinated on or maybe defecated on. That's not that common. In the area where something becomes an unusual fetish, certainly that includes body products.
Mm-hmm.
Why that's true, we don't know, and how it happens, we don't know.
And echoing Dr. Rosen's thoughts is the opening statement of the 2021 study, The Psychology of Kink, a cross-sectional survey study investigating the roles of sensation-seeking and coping style in BDSM-related interests, which sighs upon opening. Empirical research on the motives and underlying psychological mechanisms driving BDSM practitioners is scarce. Not a lot out there. But then I found this 2022 study titled Current Biopsychosocial Science on Understanding Kink, which off the bat answers our burning what exactly is kink curiosity with this tight definition. So they say that kink practices can include administering or receiving intense sensation, including but not limited to pain, eroticizing the expression of power and authority differences, being aroused by unusual sensual stimuli, including specific non-genital body parts or inanimate objects, quote, fetish, unquote, perhaps engaging in role play of erotic scenarios, and engaging in activities that induce shifts and changes in consciousness, which is called headspace in kink subcultures. It clues us in with. And if you're like, ew, freaks, the study continues to say that research finds 45 to 60% of people fantasize about kink, but only 20 to 47% act on those desires, and that the literature suggests that participants remain highly stigmatized, including by some clinicians, although no studies have found any psychopathological conditions that distinguish a group of people involved in kink from those who are not involved, generally showing that the prevalence of previous trauma and abuse experiences, especially by those who enjoy masochism, is slightly lower in kinky folks than the general population. So big shrug here. Let people do what they want if they're not hurting anyone else, unless that person asked them to hurt them and gave enthusiastic consent. But on the topic of rooting around past childhood experiences,
Bass Cliff, CeCe Thurbridge, Shakira Elahi, Jen Pompeo, Edward McGregor, and Earl of Grimalkin asked, in Bass's words, why are we not grossed out by things when we're kids, but they become really off-putting as adults?
Well, of course, and the great example of that is feces, which little kids, one-year-olds like. And something about toilet training. Contagion is a major feature of disgust. When something touches something else, something disgusting touches something else, it renders it inedible, right? Mm-hmm. You wouldn't eat your favorite food of a cockroach or to cross it or touch a piece of feces. Now, that doesn't appear until about 4 years of age. Toilet training occurs in our culture well before four. Not in all cultures, but in our culture it does. So that a kid who's at 3 years of age in our culture who says feces, you know, you show them feces, they say, ooh. But if it touches something that they like, they'll still eat it.
Mm, really?
So that comes in at about four.
Maybe they're establishing their microbiome still.
Well, then that's a different kind of account. You're trying to show how it might serve you a function.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't explain how it actually happens. But yes, you could make a statement like that.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, there are people who are much less concerned about this sort of thing, sharing food, all sorts of stuff like that, which many people find disgusting. At a dinner table, some people don't want to share other people's food.
Right.
If you bite something, no one or someone else doesn't want. Other people don't, that's fine.
Yeah.
Never mind if they love you. That's yet another thing. But even if they don't love you, or, you know, if somebody at the next table in a restaurant is eating something, you think it's sort of looking, but would you mind them having a piece? You wouldn't know it. I know people have done that, but the point is you don't mind their cutting a piece off and giving.
Right.
It might make a big difference to some people whether they cut it off with a knife, so they cut off a piece that that's never touched their lips.
Right.
Or they use their fork, which would be contaminating. So there are some people who would be very sensitive to that,
mm-hmm.
and other people who wouldn't even pay attention.
as we've evolved as a species, do you think that our disgust tolerance has changed? And a lot of people wanted to know how much of it is learned versus instinctive, how much is nature versus nurture?
Which was on the minds of Jessamy Ritchie, Brooke Hicks, Anthony Willis, Alia Myers, Britt Klein, Mariah Walser, Patricia Evans, Heather Horton Whedon, Samantha, and Earl of Grammelkin. Oh, and Mari Strombom Johnson, first-time class Jessica, and Nico Price.
There's a sense in which it's all nurtured, a sense in which, in the sense that little babies don't show any disgust.
Mm.
Disgust is universal. Probably the original disgust is something to be avoided from, you know, for health reasons. My guess is we're predisposed biologically to avoid things that, for example, smell bad. Spoiled smell is the smell of disgust.
And is that why bodies smell like inherently so disgusting to people? Like, I always read that once you smell a dead body, you never forget the odor.
Well, it depends when the body died, right?
Right.
Decaying human flesh, does it smell different from decaying other animals' flesh? I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm quite ready to believe that there's a tendency where they're predisposed to learn that that kind of smell is bad.
Oh, shoot. I had long notes here for a whole aside, but I'll cut to the chase. So there are these two compounds that are notable in dead flesh smell, and they are wonderfully named cadaverine and putrescine. And then there's another compound, benzaldehyde, and that also comes off a corpse. And the last one is said to have like this sickeningly sweet, almost almond-like smell. And apparently Bath and Body Works scent, Cherry Crisp, smells a lot like a dead person or a dying person, because it has this benzaldehyde. And so does Tom Ford's very high-end scent, Lost Cherry, because they both have benzaldehyde in them. And folks on TikTok were up in dead arms about this, and I was comment surfing, and I saw some great opinions, such as, OMG, I've smelt a deceased person, and I know exactly what the sweet smell she's talking about is. It's the worst sweet smell ever. And another person said, interesting, I remember someone died in my apartment building, and it smelled like rotten meat with old period blood, in my opinion. And then another person weighed in and said that dead people smell like rotting meat, bad armpit stink, and a weird sweet cologne, and that the sweet smell is the creepiest because it smells human. So if you would like to get a whiff, if you have a dark sensibility, I guess start with a spritz of Tom Ford Lost Cherry, apparently. On one post about it, TikToker Savannah simply commented, Tomb Ford. Nice.
Well, then you think of all these people, you know many of them, who like stinky cheese.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they like that smell, but only if it's coming from cheese.
Yeah.
If you say to them, here's something, sniff, and they smell, it's cheese, let's say. They don't know that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you say, this is a piece of Limburger cheese, say, oh, smells great. You say, oh, I'm sorry, that's ketchup. You say, oh, my God, oh, that's terrible. Same smell.
So, side note, if you wonder why some feet smell like cheese, you can thank the teeny tiny tiny Brevibacterium, which both lives on our skin to gobble up dead skin cells like its own charcuterie board, and it also ripens many cheeses such as Munster and Limburger. So it's not that your feet smell cheesy, it's probably that your cheese smells footy.
Have you ever seen those sketches where someone says, oh, this smells awful, smell this?
Hey, Kevin, you gotta try this milk, man. It's so far gone, it's unreal. Oh, stop the music. That is bad.
Why do you think we do that?
Yes, that's a very, very common thing. People like, this is what I was talking about before about benign masochism. People like to experience negative things in a safe context. That's a very safe context. They're saying your smell is, they're not going to kill you with toxin or anything.
Yeah.
People are very complicated. So they're enjoying what's negative. Some people probably enjoy defecating. Other people don't. If you said to everyone, no one's asked this question as far as I know. Would you rather be a person who didn't have to defecate?
Oh.
Some people would say no, and some people would say yes.
Some people might say, don't take that away from me.
Yeah, there's a pleasure
mm-hmm.
of expelling stuff. So we differ on all these things.
Yeah.
I assume it's the less disgust-sensitive people who are more likely to enjoy defecation or even urination.
Right. Sometimes peeing feels great. You're like, oof. But maybe that's the relief thing of being like, I'm no longer in danger.
Well, first of all, you're getting rid of fetid stuff.
Right.
So that could be a positive thing. And in addition, there is a pleasure. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, the actual act of defecation produces input to your brain from mm-hmm. your anus, and that could be positive. Mm-hmm. And there are people who, you know, sit on the pot for half an hour reading the newspaper, and they love it. And other people just want to do it and get it over with, and I wish I didn't have to do it. These are fascinating issues. They're discussed on a day-to-day basis. Mm.
I have two more listener questions. Now, there's this something called, and I'm not sure if you've heard of this, you don't strike me as someone who spends a lot of time on TikTok.
No, I've never been on TikTok.
Exactly.
Or on any, by the way, I've never been on
Facebook? Facebook?
I've never been on Facebook. I've never been on anything.
Don't bother. No, it's all garbage.
I have no interest.
It's all garbage. Your life is so much better.
Yeah.
But there is something on TikTok that is called the ick. Have you heard of this?
No.
It is, the ick is when you're attracted to someone or maybe you like them and then suddenly they do something that just the ick. Like it might be the way they eat a sandwich. It might be the way that they ride a bike.
So it's not always disgusting.
It seems
the way they ride a bike, it wouldn't be disgusting.
There's something in Laurel's words.
And also from Naomi Chaim, Emma Giles, Isabel Brooks, Hannah Michael, and yes, Laurel asked,
when it comes to dating and relationships, why is there such a sudden irreversible trigger that's sometimes so arbitrary? And I'm wondering, where is disgust and contempt? You said anger draws you close because you want to maybe hurt or engage with someone. But what is it that you just say, no, with a person or a situation?
Okay, so you could ask people, here's this person you like, mm-hmm. you thought on dating, but it turns out he drinks his urine. Mm. Now, does that kill it?
Ooh.
I'm just asking you. You see, that could contaminate the person.
Sure. Yeah. No, that makes me say the guy's got to do a lot of toothbrushing and a lot of Listerine for me to be drawn in.
Him, yeah. Yeah. But suppose you're not even in a romantic but friend. Your friend gives enemas to people in the hospital or something.
That doesn't bother me as much as someone who like overpronounces something in a language in which they're not fluent. You know, someone who does cringy behaviors that are just like, ugh, like.
Well, there's cringy behavior. There's a lot of cringy things that have nothing to do with disgust.
Okay.
So the ick has been described by some psychologists as a mix of shame, anger, disgust, and embarrassment. And some people say it is a gut reaction that person is not right for you. And others say that's not true. It's a manifestation of avoidant attachment issues that you should work through. So your mileage may vary, but don't talk yourself into something you don't want. But also keep in mind, we all have icks. I ick myself daily, and I just have to deal with it. I'm never going to break up with myself.
By the way, you'd get used to everything.
Right.
But, you know, when you make a decision right now, you might say, I wouldn't deal with that person. And then it might turn out that if you have to, you get used to it.
Well, you know, we talked a lot in the beginning about Hitler being a disgusting figure, but where does xenophobia come into play when it comes into disgust and people who might have racist or xenophobic tendencies?
This was also asked by listener Gemma, who wanted to know about decolonizing disgust.
Are they finding disgust in things that they're threatened
by? They might be finding disgust in it. For example, if someone from the despised group, could be a race, could be anything, touched something, but they not want to hold it. Mm-hmm. But they would be unwilling to wear used clothing that was worn by an ex, where an ex is someone in the group that they really are phobic to.
Right.
And we can use that as a criterion for disgust. And certainly, I'm sure some xenophobia manifests that way, that you don't want anything to do with their bodies. Or...
Ooh, lightning.
That's exciting.
Yeah, that's good lightning.
And there is some research to be had, like the 2023 paper, Body Odor Disgust Sensitivity is Associated with Xenophobia, evidence from 9 countries across 5 continents. And the 2019 address, How and Why Disgust Responses Underlie Prejudice, which notes that people treat an atypical appearance as a stronger sign of unfamiliar pathogens. And then there's also this paper that came out, Disgust is a Factor in Extreme Prejudice, which notes that bigotry may be distinguished by high levels of disgust. So we've learned that disgust crops up in situations where things won't actually harm us, but bigotry is harmful. Hence, bigotry is worthy of disgust, much more so than disgust over touching an earthworm.
What about Julia Taylor and me want to know, what's the most disgusting thing you've ever encountered? And was it smelly or gory or psychologically upsetting? What is the grossest thing about your work or the thing that you like the least?
I have not experienced this, but a rotting human body would probably be about as disgusting as... I've fortunately not had to not experience that.
Knock on wood.
On the battlefield, you might run into it. In a hospital, you might run into it, but not normally, because your body isn't rotted when you first die and it's put into the freezer or the refrigerator right away. But of course, the police run into this and buried bodies and stuff. I would suspect that that would be the most disgusting.
Yeah.
And you might expect that it should be. I mean, because it's about meat and it's about decay, and there's nothing more sensitive than human meat.
And just buckle up. We got a casual revelation coming here.
I'm not terribly disgusted, personally, by the prospect of eating human flesh if I knew that someone wasn't killed for this.
Oh, if someone, say, donated their body to a barbecue?
Yeah, if a person died, and right after that some of their muscle was harvested, I would be interested in just tasting it to see. By the way, I'm saying that when I actually faced it, I might not be.
Right.
But I think that I'm curious about that, and I don't feel widely disgusted by that.
And, you know, it's interesting because I do feel like a lot of, say, campaigns toward having a plant-based diet and eliminating meat, or campaigns pro-vegetarianism, use disgust as a factor in maybe discouraging meat consumption.
Yes, and showing people pictures of the way animals are treated, that can be a form of disgust. Absolutely. And since going toward a plant-based diet is agreed by most people who are worried about the environment to be a very good idea, I do a little work on sustainability.
Oh, yeah.
Psychology of sustainability.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I think that disgust is working in the favor of sustainability, because it's animal foods that are disgusting. And so we have this funny ambivalence about animal foods. We don't have ambivalence about vegetable foods.
Yeah.
We may not like their taste, but we don't feel there's anything deeply wrong with eating a piece of asparagus.
Right.
We're not upset about pain that it might produce or anything.
As someone who may have gotten salmonella from a cantaloupe a month or so ago, I should be forever disgusted by melons. We should have not a good relationship. But no, I had some honeydew yesterday. No ancestors warned or forbade me from diner fruit cup salmonella outbreaks. So thanks for nothing.
And the Bible doesn't have any passages about, like, definitely don't eat broccoli on a Sunday. You know what I mean? I feel like...
Yeah, almost all prohibitions, as I said, are about meat.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's right. So disgust is working in favor of sustainability.
Yeah.
In favor of vegetarianism.
You know, I'm not mad at that. I feel like if you asked me to go kill a hog, I would say absolutely not. But if you asked me to have a piece of bacon, I'd say, sure, why not? So I think it's maybe coming to terms with exactly what we're willing to do based on what we see or smell or, you know what I mean? Like, I think it's...
I'm a partial vegetarian.
Yeah.
And I've become that in the last 10 years.
Yeah.
There are three kinds of vegetarians, sort of. I mean, some people are all three. There's health vegetarians, which I am not. Then there are environmental vegetarians. There are sustainability vegetarians. I'm sympathetic with that, but that's not my core motive. My core motive is compassionate. Mm-hmm. I don't like the idea of killing animals.
Yeah. I feel you.
I don't want to be a party to that by eating meat. Now, I do eat fish, and I do eat the shellfish, and so I'm a little bit hypocritical.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sensitive to that. I don't like that either. But a lobster or a shrimp, that's a moving animal.
No, they can live forever.
In terms of sustainability, if you cut your meat intake 50%, you're doing a good job.
Yeah, that's great to know. And it's great to hear it. It's something that I'm moving toward as well. But last question I always have to ask is, what's your favorite thing about your work? What do you love the most?
Well, I love teaching. I love exposing, not so much about disgust, but I do teach a little about that. But I like to open students' eyes to the wonders of the world and to how we can actually find out things like what's going on in the head without looking, looking in the head, indirectly. I love to show them that. So I care a lot about teaching. preparing people to be good thinkers in the modern world. I like to find things out. I enjoy being puzzled by something and then saying, I wonder what's going on there, and being able to say, well, here, I have some idea now about what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
I love to look at the world and see something that doesn't make sense to me. My first study on food was about why would people eat hot pepper when it tastes so bad?
Oh, that's a great question. Have you ever seen, you probably haven't seen this on YouTube, but it's called Hot Ones. It's celebrity interviews with people who are, you know, great actors and serious Oscar-winning actors. And they're in a room with a bunch of hot wings. Then they go from mild to call an ambulance, and they see how far they can get. And it's people like Kate Blanchett and Paul Rudd, and they're in so much pain. But it's something that, once again, we hate to have it happen to us. We don't mind watching it, though.
Well, but no, but we like it until it gets too painful.
Yeah, exactly.
That was what got me onto benign massacre. It was eating hot chili pepper. And I did some work in a Mexican village on it. And everyone in the village over 4 or 5 eats hot pepper and likes it. Mm-hmm. And none of the animals in the village do, even though they eat it. Because they eat the garbage.
Yeah.
So they eat hot pepper, but they don't get to like it.
Oof.
So that was, to me, saying there's something about humans here.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out it is about humans.
We got too much brains for our own good, huh?
Yeah, well, these are sort of side effects of having a big brain.
Mm-hmm.
There are many side effects of having a big brain. I mean, you know, once you've got this brain that can do all sorts of things and imaginations, all kinds of things happen.
Mm-hmm. And they're fascinating.
Just a heads up, there's a New Mexico chili pepper scientist very much on my list. I'm coming for you. I'm coming in hot. But that is in the future. And right now, let's shutter up our disgust.
What a great time.
Thank you so much for talking to me.
So ask delightful people disgusting questions, because you might find yourself chatting about hot peppers and hopefully consensual cannibalism just in the middle of a thunderstorm. Now, we have linked more about Dr. Rosin in the show notes. Thank you, Dr. Rosin, so much for doing this, along with the charities of choice. And no, you will not find his handle on TikTok anytime soon if you want to be online friends. But we are at Ologies on Twitter and Instagram. I'm on both as Allie Ward. Allie has one L. I'm doing a terrible job on TikTok, but I am there. We also have Smologies episodes, which are filth-free. They're cleaned up for kids. They're shorter versions of our classics. To join the Ologies Patreon and leave questions for guests, you can head over to patreon.com/ologies, where it costs $1 a month to join. Ologies merch is available at the link in the show notes, too. Thank you to Aaron Talbert for managing the Ologies podcast Facebook group. Aveline Malik and The Wordery make our professional transcripts. Noelle Dilworth is scheduling producer. Susan Hale is our managing director. Kelly Ardwire makes the website. We welcome brand new second editor Jake Chaffee into the fold. Jake is amazing. We're getting ready for a little exciting shift and an addition in programming, debuting on May 16th. So mark your calendars for that, folks. Our lead editor is the very palatable Mercedes Maitland of Maitland Audio. Nick Thorburn made the theme music. And if you stick around until the end of the episode, I tell you a secret. And this is one of the most disgusting things that has ever happened to me, ever. And I'm going to tell you about it. So during this trip to Philly, I overscheduled myself in a way that could have actually killed me. I'm surprised it didn't. I did 10 interviews in like 3 or 4 days. I did a keynote to 5,000 people. I had a ton of meetings. And then I had an immediate flight to Catalina Island to teach this symposium. Stress was high. Sleep was little. I was not doing well. So when I got home, I started to come down with pneumonia, as you may remember I had in July. Now, at the same time, flies started appearing in our house. Like, not tiny fruit flies, not cute fruit flies, like big, hairy, gross flies. No idea where they came from. First, there's just one or two, and we're like, ugh. And then over the course of a week, we were killing like 30 flies a day. I couldn't take it. Jarrett has this thing called an assault rifle, and it shoots like a high-powered mist of table salt. This thing is deadly and effective against bugs. It's not humane. I'm sorry, I couldn't deal with them inside. Does it aerosolize fly guts and then you breathe them in? We're not going to think about it. But my anxiety was through the roof, being so sick with these disgusting iridescent bottle flies everywhere. We kept all the doors shut. We sealed up all the cracks, and they kept finding their way in. And we eventually killed them all. And about a week later, I took out our Swiffer from the broom closet and I saw fly egg cases in the back corner. And what had happened was this one bitch fly laid eggs in a Swiffer wet jet maxi pad thing. And I hadn't taken off the dirty one before shoving it in the closet. So they just nested in there. That's where they were coming from. They were hatching out of a Swiffer wet jet maxi pad. And anyway, it was truly a blight on my mental health. I think about it and I start choking with anxiety. Anyway, remove the old Swiffer thing before storing it because I didn't know that this horror show was even possible. Also, we have a whole episode on flies and I try to get us to like flies. We're doing our best over here, all right? Also, I can't remember if I've told you the secret before, but I feel like it's so embarrassing I probably haven't. If I have, I hope you got the detail that you've been craving. Anyway, I'm sorry, flies. Just please go find a dead possum or something instead of a mop. If only I was able to make hot dogs out of the flies. I'm gonna... Actual gagging. I took that too far. Pull it back. Okay, bye-bye.
Pachydermatology. Homeology. Cryptozoology. Lithology. Nanotechnology. Meteorology.
That's gross. I love it.
While no one knows what tomorrow may bring, Bridgestone is working toward a more positive outlook. With innovations like developing a tire using 75% recycled and renewable materials. It's just one of the many ways Bridgestone is making a difference today for generations to come. Because that's what really matters. Bridgestone, solutions for your journey. Visit whatreallymatters.com to learn more.
What do 8 bags of concrete mix, a cooler full of 30-pound sea bass, and a 10-inch compound miter saw have in common? They're all things that are easier to load in and out of the bed of the new F-150. Thanks to its new available Pro-Access tailgate that's also a swing gate, the new 2024 Ford F-150, tough this smart, can only be called F-150.
Available starting early 2024, Pro-Access tailgate available starting spring 2024, cargo and load capacity limited by weight and weight distribution.